Liz, what a great job you and your housemates did the other night for your housewarming. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
And you seem very, very popular. A lot of people showed up. You want to be the pastor someday? There's a lot of folks there. It was beautiful. We're going to ask Liz to read for us from the book of Revelation, chapter 21, the first seven verses, Revelation 21, 1 through 7.
Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children."
Thank you, Liz. God bless
you.
I want to be, I can't do it in person because they're not with us, but through the screen, I'm going to say a welcome to the little Forrest, who I'm sure is watching with his parents, and we're anxious to see them. Meaningful about this, the arrival of this little one named Forrest, is, what is he? He's my great nephew or something like that? Anyway, we lost my uncle this week, my dad's brother, and their father's name was Forrest. And so we're having kind of a circle of life moment as we say we remember this loss in the family and this new birth. I want to welcome a special friend, Tim Stanek, over there in the corner. Would you raise your hand? Yeah, go ahead. Tim is the pastor of Southside Christian Church. That church has been experiencing a real renewal in the last couple of years. And Tim is a real brother and friend in the Lord. And we get together at least every other week to talk about life and God. And I appreciate you, Tim, and it's good to see you. He's on vacation, and that's why he's with us today. Glenda and I, speaking of vacation, will be leaving later this week, along with my parents and my siblings and their spouses, for one of those bucket list kind of vacations. We're going to catch a cruise up and down the coast of Alaska. So I won't be here next week when Mike Evans is with you, but I urge you, you won't want to miss next week. His energy and his singing, his energy and his preaching, you'll be blessed. Summer is that kind of travel season, not just for us, but for many of you in different weeks. And we'll look forward to catching up with you again when we're all back in the same room. But during the summer, you're going to have a sampling, a buffet, actually, of guest speakers. You're going to hear at some point from Pastor Katie. How long has it been since you heard from her? That'll be good. Mike Bachmeyer will also be here. He helped lead us through a season of sabbatical, and a great relationship was strengthened there and a lot of trust, and we're looking forward to having him and Vicky with us. Can I tell you one of the most challenging roles that I have as a pastor? It's the funeral of someone I don't know that well. Sometimes the funeral home will call me, John, are you available on such and such day? Family doesn't have a pastor. Can you officiate at that particular funeral? And everybody present at that funeral is wanting the best possible perspective on this life that I hardly know, the life of the loved one that they lost. They want the best perspective. Well, not everybody wanted that exactly. One time I got a phone call from the funeral home, and the director said, John, two middle-aged women brought the cremains of their father to us, and they want a small service. As far as I can tell, they hate their father, and they don't have a pastor, and I'm just asking, would you mind being there? I said, will they meet with me? And he said, no, made it very clear to me they were not going to meet with the pastor. They just wanted a small service. I said, well, did they tell you anything about their dad? And he said, not very much, but they did say two things. He loved Elvis Presley music and rummage sales. That's what I had to go on. So I believe with the Lord's help, I preached a little message called One Man's Trash is Another Man's Treasure. And I tried to help them see that maybe the way they see each other, I was discreet the way I did it, might not be the same way God sees them or us, and hopefully for them to look for the treasure. Those who call a Christian minister to preside over a funeral usually have beliefs about heaven and hell. And many are hoping that somewhere in my little message, I'm going to say something about the deceased being in heaven. To be honest with you, more and more my perception is that many people, if not most, assume that they're generally entitled to heaven. It's as if we're going to be born, we're going to live, we're going to die, and we're going to live in a better place. And so you go to visitations and you go to funerals and you hear people say, well, at least he's in a better place. That may be, but in those cases, I don't know very well. All I can say is, I hope so. Worse than doing a funeral of someone that you barely know is doing one for someone you know well and you don't like what you know about them. I remember the funeral of a lady that I'd had some contact with over the years. And part of her life, she'd made her money by being an exotic dancer. That's not how I knew her. Also known for her excessive drinking and her violence. And I knew some of this about her, but I collected a few more stories before the actual funeral. And one of the family stories that they told me was one time she was so drunk and so angry, somebody she didn't like was in her house, and she picked that guy up and threw him out the window of her house. That wasn't the end of the story. The guy picked himself up, meekly went back into the house where she saw him again and chose another window to throw him out of. How was I supposed to know what to say at a funeral like that? Especially when they're looking for some sort of statement about eternity. Well, I hope with the Lord's help, I took my text from Ecclesiastes and read to them, it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting or party. For death is the destiny of everyone, and the living should take this to heart. And I reminded them that sometimes life and its meaning is more clearly seen through the eyes wet with tears rather than bloodshot with other influences. And I tried to help that little congregation understand the significant and consequential impact of our choices and hope that in the house of mourning they might gain a clearer vision of what their life could become. The text that I really want to read in full faith at every funeral that I preach includes these words from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning with verse 16. I want to read, for the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. And after that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will be with the Lord forever. Therefore, encourage one another with these words. That's the text I really want to preach at every sermon I'm a part of. But those encouraging verses can't automatically be applied to everyone. Right there in the text, it says that it applies to those who've died in Christ. And those who are still living in Christ when he returns. Now, anyone who knows me and who heard Liz read this text this morning will understandably think you know where I'm going to go in my preaching today, because I've preached a number of times before using the very text that she read for us. You probably thought I was going to be preaching some version of my with sermon. That word is so important to me. It's the cornerstone of my understanding of the entire Bible, the passion of God to be with. You probably, those of you who heard it before, probably knew that I was going to start in Revelation and then go right to the beginning of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 2, and I was going to put my finger on the first wrong thing in the Garden of Eden. And it wasn't a sin. It was that it was not good for man to be alone. In other words, to be not with. Those of you who've really been paying attention over the years probably thought that I'd go right from the Garden of Eden over to those boring genealogies in Genesis chapter 5. So-and-so begat so-and-so, lived this many more years, had kids, etc., etc., etc. But focusing on the most strangest entry of that genealogy, where Enoch walked with God and disappeared. Enoch walked with God, there's that word with again, and disappeared. You would have probably remembered my explanation of why that would have happened. My imagination is God had waited eons to wait to have somebody to be with. And finally he had Adam and Eve, but it was so short and they were gone again. And here comes this guy who gets what it means to want to be with. And God said, I'm not waiting till eternity to take this one home. And as far as I know, God and Enoch are still walking with each other. And yeah, you probably would remember my reference at least a little bit to Noah, who saved his entire family because he walked with the Lord. Well, maybe it was the excessively hot weather this week that turned my attention to the direction that I'm going to go today. Or maybe it was just a general sense of responsibility that I feel that I have to you at all times. But today I want to talk to you about what we call hell. In other words, what it means to be not with. Now, let me take you back to our text that Liz read. And if you read the chapter straight through, you're going to arrive at a verse where you could almost get whiplash in the way the energy of the text turns. Let's read verse 1. Here we are at this beautiful, hopeful, exciting, attractive start to the chapter. John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth." Anybody tired of the old? Has anybody noticed the old is wearing out? "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, no longer any sea." Now, personally, I would want to see, but the sea was keeping John from those that he loved, because he was banished to an island. No more banishment. "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the Lord saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now with the people, and he will dwell with them. They'll be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He'll wipe every tear from their eyes. No more funerals, no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.' And he who was seated on the throne said, 'I'm making everything new.' Then he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. It's done. I'm the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I'm going to give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children.'" Everything brand new. The energy of a bride and bridegroom and his bride on their wedding day. God's voice is loud and excited. Tears are wiped away. No more death. No more anxiety about separation from those that you love. "Write it down. You can hold me to account on this," God says. It's all going to be different. And then there's that interesting word inserted into verse 7. Those who are victorious will inherit all this. "And I will be their God, and they will be my children." Victorious? You mean there's a battle to be fought? You mean it's not just what I'm entitled to? Well, that sure makes me curious. Who are the unvictorious? Now, I'm going to give you a little list that the Bible gives us of 8 unvictorious types of people. Let me say something at the outset. This list does not apply to everyone who at one point or however many points in your life sinned. This is talking about people whose characterology are positioned this direction away from God. But I'm going to give you a list of 8 ways of being disqualified from participating in the joy that I just read you about. And often in the Bible, when we're giving a list of things, we're giving it in order of priority. And I think that's the case in this particular list. So if it's true that we're going to hear a list, and the most important thing to listen to is the first thing on the list, what do you imagine the first sin mentioned is going to be? You think it's going to be mass murder? Maybe it's someone who just can't control their appetites and unfaithful and immoral all over the place. Well, here it is. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, they will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. That's right next to the passages about that beautiful wedding kind of day. All that joy and then this warning. These are the ones who will not be with. And the first on the list are the cowards. Again, didn't you think it was going to be murder or some other deviance? Some other kind of unfaithfulness? I should reassure you, cowardice in this context is not the fear of jumping out of an airplane strapped to someone else. We're not talking about that kind of cowardice. This kind of being cowardly is what delayed for 40 years the entrance of God's people into the promised land. Early in the time of Moses, he was leading Israel through the wilderness towards the promised land. And there came a day when he commissioned 12 spies to go into the promised land to scope it out so they would know what challenges are waiting for them and what strategies they would need to successfully take the promised land. 10 of the 12 spies came back and said, "We can't do it. They're bigger than us. They're taller than us. They're stronger than us. They're smarter than us. They're everything else more than us. We need to stay here in the wilderness where it's safe. Well, at least it's familiar here. At least it's cozy here. We can't do it. The enemy's too big." And because of that cowardice, God's people did circles in the wilderness for 40 years until all of the cowards had died and missed their opportunity to live in the promised land. Scott Peck, a now deceased, important Christian psychiatrist, says that cowardice is listed first because if you're living in a cowardly manner, you're already living in the torments of hell. You're already telling yourself, what if I would have? What if I could have? What if I should have? Should I try that? Should I not? Oh, was that a mistake? Oh, how's it going to turn out? I'm going to stay in my own corner. I'm going to play it safe. It feels like hell. God gave his people another chance after Moses died, and he was going to address Joshua, and he was going to make sure that there weren't going to be 40 more years of doing circles because of cowardice. Joshua chapter 1, beginning with verse 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide. By the way, Joshua was one of the 2 of the 12 spies that said, we can do this. God is with us. We can do this. So he and Caleb survived those 40 years. Verse 2. Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I'm about to give to them, to the Israelites. I'll give you every place where you set your foot. Okay, I'm going to tell you something important about not being a coward. You can have the most vivid imagination of the desirable future that you want in God or in life. And it's a beautiful and safe thing to keep it in your imagination. But the promise of God is for those who make a step towards it. Wherever you set your foot, I'll give that. Not just your imagination, not just your dream, but your effort, your act of faith in stepping forward in the command and in the invitation of God. Verse 3 again. I'll give you every place where you set your foot. As I promised Moses, your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon and from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country, foot by footstep by footstep, to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. as I was with Moses, so I'll be with you. I'll never leave you or forsake you. And now he gives him the medicine that we must have to defeat cowardice. Be strong and, here's the word, courageous. Now let me just make a comment about the word courage. Especially in big, important things, most human beings don't really want courage. You know what we want? We want confidence. I want to know for sure it's going to turn out this way. I want to know for sure it's going to have a good end. We want to be confident of the choice we're going to make about this job, about this marriage, about this church, about whatever it is. And God is saying, look, you're going to new territory. You can't have confidence. Because confidence comes only when you've done something 100 times and you know it like the back of your hand and you can do it in the dark. What you need is not confidence, but courage. Take the step. Move forward in spite of your anxiety, in spite of your fear. Be strong and courageous. I'm going to keep reading a little bit because I just want you to see that God repeats this. This is what we've got to hear repeatedly. Because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their ancestors to give them. Here it is again. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Don't turn from it to the right or the left, that you may be successful where you go. That's why God is urging us to be courageous, because it's required if you're going to be successful. You're going to have to go to new and what feels like dangerous territory. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night so that you might be careful to do everything in it. Then you'll be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. The victory, the first victory that Joshua needed to win in going to the promised land was the victory of any cowardice he might have, and instead to act in courage. The second sin listed is the sin of unbelieving. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, they will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. Our umpteenth great-grandfather in the faith, his name was Abraham. He was very familiar with his homeland. It was called Ur. And one day the voice of the Lord came to him and said, I want you to leave home. One little catch. I'm not going to tell you where you're going to go. You're just going to need to walk with me. You're just going to believe me that this is the voice of the Lord that you're hearing and that I'm going to be with you and not going to forsake you. Abraham was asked to leave the familiarity of his homeland to go to an unknown land. He just had to trust. He just had to believe and follow. Here's how Hebrews 11 put it. By faith, Abraham, when called to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. Again, we humans, we want it to be sure. We want it to be confident. And there's just a faith that we need to have. His faith was tested with his situation with his wife. They were too old to have children, and God said, I'm going to give you a child. And for 25 years, he didn't perfectly wait, but for 25 years, he had to wait for that promise to be fulfilled. And then, wouldn't you know it, some years later, God tested him again about his faith, about his son. He said, I want you to offer your son as a sacrifice to me. Now, that's got to sound strange to you, but it wouldn't have been as strange in that culture at that time. There are many religions that were offering their children to gods. But God was going to have a different kind of outcome, and he was not going to allow Isaac to be killed. And so he stopped Abraham before he could offer his sacrifice. But it made him know that this man trusts me. This man believes me, because he knew that that child was a child of promise, and that if the Lord took him, he'd return him. In fact, again, from Hebrews. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son. Even though God had said to him, it's through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God would raise the dead. And so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Abraham believed God, even in the face of death, even in the face of the potential of his son's death. I won't spend as much time on the rest of the list, but let's look at the rest of the list. I wanted to focus on those two most important given our limited time. Verse 8 of Revelation 21. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, and the vile. Within the word vile is the idea of it's reprehensible. And there may be things that you're going to imagine that would be reprehensible. One of the things that's reprehensible to me is human trafficking that happens so much at the border these days, and sex trafficking. I have a friend that this week, he and his wife were involved in a ministry in Chicago trying to help numerous women caught up in sex trafficking, just vile uses of each other. Here's one next on the list that we would expect to be on the list, the murderers, people whose only concern is their own life, and they're willing to expend or make unimportant the life of others and kill, even kill, to have their way. Next on the list, the sexually immoral, those who don't trust God's purposes and His guidance for our sexuality and our marriages, instead saying that everything between consenting adults is okay. May I remind you, the very first sin in the book of Genesis, chapter 3, was between two consenting adults. Even if we would all conspire against God and His ways, wouldn't make us innocent. Adam and Eve were consenting adults. Then there are those who practice magic arts. They're appealing to spirits other than God to try to get their way and maybe to manipulate reality. Exercising power over others, voodoo dolls or whatever else, and unwilling to wait on the Lord and to trust the Lord, trying to create their own realities. The idolaters, those are folks that have put anything in the place of God. That could even be money, popularity, fame. Those who imagine and insist on the ideal life, the idolatrous life, and likely in their dream, no cross to bear. All liars are on that list, those who live their life based on falsehoods. They will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. These are those who will not be with. I say that with no pleasure, and I think the Lord spoke it with no pleasure. What do we make of a God of love who's willing to live in the same universe as those consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur? First of all, my teaching today is not intended to answer all our questions about hell, its location, its timetable, things like that. There are a lot of respected evangelical theologians that have this theory or that theory, and that's not my thing today. My agenda today is just to warn us that there is an alternative to heaven. There is an alternative to the holy city that I don't want anything to do with, and I don't want you to have anything to do with. And I want to serve us through this warning. How can the God of love be in the same universe as that kind of situation? Here's my own view. I believe that Jesus believes in radical freedom. And I hope in a few minutes, I hope you'll see how radical I believe that freedom is. I do not believe that God is coercive. I believe that God allows us to have the life that we most deeply want within the constraints of reality. In other words, I can't wish that I can float. I can make my own choices, but I can't always choose my own consequences. That's just reality. But I believe God allows us to have the life that you most deeply desire within the constraints of reality. The first words of Jesus spoken in the Gospel of John to potential disciples was not a sermon, was not a command to obey. It was an open-ended question. Hear this word. I wonder if you'd give Jesus permission to ask you this question. What do you want? Those are the first red letters in the Gospel of John. What do you want? What do you desire? How incredibly important that question is. That's why Jesus sometimes told us to ask, seek, knock, ask again, keep on asking, keep on seeking, because the more you ask, the more it's going to reveal what you most deeply want. Those things you ask for once and forget, oh, that's not what you deeply want. But the things that persist reveal what you want. Jesus is not going to manipulate you or me into following Him. He's given you a free will. Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote about this in a fictional piece of literature called The Grand Inquisitor. And in that literature, a bishop comes to confront Jesus and say, Jesus, you did wrong. When you went to the wilderness and when you declined the opportunity to turn stones into bread, do you realize what we could have done with every gravel pit in the world? We could have turned it into bread and all of the world would follow us. Jesus, you did wrong when you didn't throw yourself down from that high tower to be rescued at just the last possible second. Because everybody loves a magic show. Everybody loves displays of power and miracles. They would have all been fascinated and never leave us. Jesus, you did wrong. We could have controlled them by their appetite for the spectacular. And then when you didn't bow down and rule, we could have had everybody. But Jesus believed in radical freedom. Fyodor Dostoevsky was writing that novel on the verge of the taking over of communism. Communism coming into the Soviet Union. Communism is about not free will. And Dostoevsky was trying his best to let the world know that God believes in radical free will. Jesus could have used his miracles to awe people so much so that they would make him king. I can prove that. John chapter 6. He multiplied bread and fish and fed 5,000 and then kind of disappeared. And large groups of people went looking for him. To do what with him, do you know? To make him king. Jesus, if you'll keep multiplying bread, you'll be our king. Jesus goes, okay. Doesn't Jesus want followers? I'll just keep multiplying bread then. But he says something cryptic like, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can't follow me. And his crowd got small. Oh, Jesus, the opportunities you miss by not coercing us. There's one other important story, Jesus story to me. When Jesus had possession of all authority in heaven and earth, he had a conversation with Pilate. Pilate said to him, don't you realize I have the power either to free you or kill you, crucify? Jesus answered, you'd have no power over me if it weren't given you from above. Jesus knew that he had authority from above as well. Jesus knew that he could have used his authority to command a special commando band of angels. Come rescue me. This is unjust. This is unfair. He could have done that. But here's what Jesus did with his authority. He gave permission to Pilate to beat him and even to crucify him. Listen to this. Jesus believes in radical freedom even if it kills him. Here's my real challenge as a pastor, not the funerals I mentioned. My real challenge is that a part of my job description is I've been warned to warn. There's a different prophet who was warned to warn in the book of Ezekiel. I want to read it because it's one of the most clear commands of a teacher or a preacher or a prophet to warn. Chapter 3, verse 17, it says, son of man, this is God speaking, I've made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall give them warning from me. If I say to the wicked, oh, it doesn't matter, you're going to go to heaven anyway. That's not what it says, is it? If I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way in order to save his life, that wicked person will die for his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand. In other words, if I don't want to give the bad news, they're still going to be judged for their sin, but I'm going to be held account that they didn't have the chance to repent. But if you warn the wicked and he does not turn from his wickedness or from his wicked way, he shall die for his iniquity, but you will have delivered your own soul. Why did God interrupt the exciting words of Revelation 21 to talk about a lake of fire? To save our lives. He wants to be with all of us, not just some of us. Please pay attention to the heart of the matter that I'm preaching about today. God wants to be with all of us in a new heaven and a new earth. He wants to share with us that place in eternity where every tear will be wiped away, where death and its threat of separation will be banished, buried forever. No more sorrow, no more pain. But he's not willing to insist on your presence there or on mine. Let us encourage one another to live with courage. If the Lord challenges us, if he invites us to take a step forward to the promised land, if he confronts us about our error, let's have the guts to make whatever changes we need in our life to live courageously and to encourage each other in that and to trust deeply in God's promises and to reject the pattern of this world which leads to a fiery destruction. Let's embrace the radical freedom that Jesus offers, a freedom to choose life, love, and faith over fear, unbelief, and sin. Now, Christ community is always going to be emphasizing the love and the mercy of God because, after all, mercy does triumph over judgment. Hallelujah. Christ community will always hold dearly, and it'll be prominent, the gospel, which is otherwise known as the good news. But ever so often, we're going to need to remember that God does not insist that we accept his mercy and that Jesus is willing to respect our radical freedom, even if it kills him. I wonder if I could ask the worship team to please come.